This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
The title of this paper, evidently not. A few people have asked me, what the hell does that mean? So I'll get it over and quickly. It's simply the idea that the evidence for Indigenous participation in colonial economies in Australia, in the National Museum at least, is actually very poor. That material evidence is just not there when we go and look for it. So, you know, the evidence is not there. The paper is an outcome of the museum's collaboration with the ANU under the linkage project on Indigenous participation in the colonial economy. So the emphasis throughout this is on the colonial economies. The engagement was stimulated by the belief that the research would be useful for informing exhibition content on that topic of colonial economies and Indigenous participation, and for allowing the collection of objects that might be identified during that research. So an essential preliminary was naturally to go through the museum's collections, searching for objects from the Australian colonial period that might reflect such Indigenous engagements. And surprisingly, there was very little that could be found. Little that is in the way of objects linked directly to Indigenous use in a Western economic practice. Certainly, we have extensive collections of traditional cultural objects, such as spears and boomerangs, bags, containers, tools, and so on. So we've got some, you know, massive collections, thousands of spears and thousands of baskets and everything else. These collections encompass both pre-contact Australia, the colonial period, and continue through to the present day with modern boomerangs and modern cultural artefacts. They often reflect an economic exchange, thus certainly participation in an economy, either between Indigenous people or between Indigenous and non-Indigenous participants. Basically, this means the items were bought, gifted or traded, quite legitimately. They do reflect an engagement with economies, both ancient, historical and current. We also have extensive collections of contemporary cultural objects, particularly arts and crafts, in all their expressions, from bark paintings to contemporary glassworks. These works are often acquired not merely because of their aesthetic value, but because of the strong narratives they represent. Sacred and secular histories, biographies, experiences represented through the object. In creating and selling these works, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have again engaged with the Australian economies. These are collections from the Canning Stock Group collection, which we've recently acquired. A work by Peter Edwards on the Stolen Generations. Peter did this when she was 16 years old, and we acquired that last year. And a Dennis Nona work on it's a skull from the Torres Strait. Coming of the Light, Torres Strait again. What characterises such acquisitions is there can be no doubt that the items are direct expressions of Indigenous cultures and histories. They are created by Indigenous makers and have a strong Indigenous narrative behind that creation. And as you stroll through the galleries, you'll see an object from afar and you'll immediately know that it's Indigenous and telling an Indigenous story. However, over its short 25-year life, the museum has also collected more unconventional objects. Objects used by Indigenous Australians, but which cannot be directly assigned to an Indigenous creator. These are objects associated with engagements with making history, but the objects themselves may not have been made or modified by the Indigenous owner. For example, we have tools and clothes and papers, documents and so on. So L.B. Clark's riding suit, L.B. Clark from Framlingham, cycled, I think, across Australia for reconciliation. Jackie Huggins, her outfit, which she used in a lot of her presentations and a lot of her meetings in Indigenous rights movements. Ted Simpson, the first Indigenous mayor of in New South Wales. Rodney Dillon's wetsuit, one of my favourite objects. Because people say, how can an object have anything to do with Aboriginal, or how can a wetsuit have anything to do with Aboriginal history? All these people were, you know, strong characters, activists who have made history in their own right. The Bowerville chairs, the ones that look blurry out of focus photograph, but the chairs at the back, of course, are the chairs that white visitors to the theatre would sit in The chairs at the front were reserved for the Aboriginal members of the audience who had to sit down the front. Barrowville in the 68 referendum was the only place to vote no. This is Joe McGuinness's Wharfie's hook and his lunchbox. He worked as a Wharfie. Joe McGuinness, again, was an activist fighting for civil rights. So these are simple things, these simple objects, not Indigenous made, but nonetheless very iconic about in an Indigenous histories. The fry pan, which anyone who's worked in Ernabalup will no doubt recognise, or anyone who's worked with batik, again, an icon for an industry. Museums are about telling stories through objects. Thus, we require appropriate objects with appropriate stories. And what happens, however, when those objects and stories don't survive or are separated over time? This is thrown into sharp relief when looking for evidence in collections of Indigenous participation in the colonial economy, particularly when that engagement was through participation in Western economic activities. That is, when an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person entered Western employment. In taking up Western economic accoutrements, clothing, housing, tools, transport and the like, Indigenous workers become increasingly invisible in the material record. Typically, when the objects they utilised are located, they are automatically assigned to Western colonial collections. Indigenous participation in the colonial economy, beyond that which produced readily identified Indigenous cultural material, is virtually invisible in museum collections. Now, enlightened by this observation, we can proceed to look at collections a little bit differently. However, we're still constrained. When using an authentic little thingy, Indigenous cultural object, I can say used by. I have a spear which was used by Aboriginal people to hunt or to trade. But when I'm using a Western object with no documented use by an Indigenous person, that's no documented use, it doesn't mean it wasn't, it just means I can't prove it, I must still say of the type used by. There's a degree of separation which isn't popular in museums. You can have objects which are so far separated from the stories they're trying to tell, they just don't engage audiences. No matter how strong the historical and sometimes circumstantial evidence of people within the industry represented by that item, confirmation of actual use will always be speculative. So how might we address this invisibility? How could we raise the profile of these engagements? The material record, that the collections of objects, stand in stark contrast to what we know about Indigenous lives in both colonial and post-colonial Australia. There are strong written and oral histories, and in particular we have the recorded image, both graphically and photographically. I have to use the standard cliche here, is that more research needs to be done. Objects and materials need to be identified that museums can utilise in the telling of stories of that Indigenous engagement in the 19th century. This is not a failing of researchers, historical researchers. Great work has been done, as we've seen today, and as you know, through our own lives, experiences and readings. There's a wealth of information out there about engagements with Indigenous people in economies in the 19th century. But it's a failing of museums to not recognise objects that may have alternative histories and to not take that into consideration in their collecting strategies. So what might we look for, both in our collections and in future collecting, that might help us tell these stories? Slideshow. Look at this image by Augustus Earle. It's a famous image of the convict era. Looking at the characters, I began to query whether some of them may or may not be Aboriginal. I have no evidence from the apart from appearance. It's the physical features. There's also, in many of the characters represented, there's a just general disregard both for the situation and for the clothing they wear. There's not enough information there to include the characters there are Indigenous, but Augustus Earle was not a caricaturist. He was effectively a documentary artist. He worked, he travelled with Darwin. He made important documentary images from through the 1830s, 1840s. So I don't think he's exaggerating the features. I'm thinking he's actually producing what he saw. Whether or not there are Indigenous people in this image, it raises the issue of how were Aboriginal people in developing urban centres represented in the jail system. Now, what was happening when I was writing this on Saturday, it was all speculative. And thanks to what we've heard this morning, it is no longer speculative. We've had strong evidence of Indigenous incarceration. So it, you know, it's a bit of coincidence. There's a lot of coincidence in this paper, by the way. I can now jump over. Quite clearly, we know Indigenous people were represented in the prison system in colonial Australia, and not just up, you know, the 1918. It's right through through to the 1900s and so on. We know that they were arrested, tried, transported, and executed, but they're often the most famous cases. The identities of the less famous, the drunk and disorderly, or the loiterers, or the beggars, the petty thieves, the immodestly attired, or those who are just sort of offensive to the public, are not so easy to determine. So, accepting that Indigenous people were imprisoned, what happens next? Certainly, as we again heard this morning, convicts were put to work in breaking rocks, building roads, walls, and making bricks. We can look at this image and other images and extract material culture. We have the chains, convict uniforms. Notice the cap on this individual. Some of the coats and jackets people are wearing. Chains down here. And in particular, the pipe. We'll get into the smoking theme as well. You'll notice a few people here have pipes. Then we leap. This is a convict cap, which is held in our collections. We know it's a convict cap, but we have no other information about provenance. It may have been or may not have been worn by an Aboriginal person. We don't know. A convict jacket, a convict shirt, a broken clay pipe, convict-made bricks, convict period axe, a pit saw, and conveniently a harpoon, which comes in later again. Now, these are all tools. They're assigned to the convict period. They're found in convict services. There's no evidence, written evidence, to support that they were used by Aboriginal convicts, but there's nothing to say they weren't. So, again, these are objects of the type that may have been used by. But in no other way, the convicts, people using these tools, were involved in activities relevant to economic development, building the communication system, buildings, houses, roads and such. Next, you know, the police. We're all aware of native police and police trackers, or more convict paraphernalia. Take these images from Oscar's sketchbook in the 19th century drawings by a Queensland Aboriginal youth who was moved to a station. Again, these are native police. Notice again, the pipe is a common theme. Clothing, the suits, the swagger sticks and such. And here we have, again, more aspects of clothing, more pipes, guns. Now, in our collections, we certainly have guns. We have rifles and pistols. And they're certainly of the type that were issued to the native police. But, again, I can't prove that they were used by native police simply because that documentation doesn't exist. They were moved across into the Western collections. The pastoral industry, I don't think it needs any great description here. Everyone knows a great contribution that Aboriginal people have made and continue to make to the pastoral industry. We have holdings of stockworkers' equipment, branding irons, saddles, bridles, harnesses. Most of them are recent, however, and their provenance is well known. Any evidence for similar materials in the pre-20th century is poor. Rusty branding iron, discarded horseshoe, picked up from any cattle or sheep station from across Australia, may just as likely have belonged to an Aboriginal worker as to the white pastoralist or stockman. This is the Wave Hill Spur, which is currently on display downstairs in our Civil Rights exhibition. It's, I think, from about the 1960s, sorry. But and we know its history. It was issued to Aboriginal stockmen. But again, finding a spur on a station without that provenance, we would be confused. And a horseshoe. Any horseshoe is, they're common, but who owned the horse they came from? Or who was driving? Pearl diving. How'd I get the pearl diving? Okay, pearlers and sailing crews. Again, we have good, strong histories of Aboriginal people working in the pearl diving industry and working on ships. But again, if we have in our collections Despite we have this, here we have this lovely image, fully dressed, kitted out. Here's a diver's helmet. We have no proof. This diver's helmet doesn't go into Indigenous history collections. It's not part. It goes into our Western European economic history collections. Again, the same with the pearl diver's bag. The lugger. It would be nice to have a lugger on display as an Indigenous object. One's been offered to us, by the way. Ship's crews. Not just divers, but ship's crews, as we've also seen this morning. A rock painting up in the inland from Borroloola of a steamship. It's actually got the boiler, and behind Jackie Green's head there's the rudder and everything else. So it's obviously had an impact on people and probably reflects serving on those vessels. Now I'm going to go through dozens of these sorts of examples now. Farmers. Corranderk in Victoria. These photographs, this is where photographs have such a great value, even drawings. It's entitled Fishing Scene. Here in the background are the Corranderk Mission, the Corranderk Farms hop plantation. The Corranderk community had fantastic success growing hops, so much so that they were complained about and there were attempts to shut them down because they were competing with European settlers and growing hops, and they're much more effective. But again, all the farming tools, all the farming implements would normally not be associated with this engagement with the economy. Again, more guns, camping equipment, billies, cooking equipment, the house itself. Ploughs used by the farmers. Shearers. These are the children of some Aboriginal shearers working in the shed. So there's just such a great photo I had to throw in. This is in domestic service. Here we have... it's not going to be pointing at the screen with my finger, is it? The Aboriginal person here is watering the horses, and this person is offering water to the customers. So this is at the Canning Post Office in Western Australia, where it's a scene of the Aboriginal people who are associated, worked for the post office to provide this support to passers-by. Aboriginal nanny in domestic service. And again, here's an Aboriginal domestic servant putting out the tea. Where is it? Government House, somewhere. But well documented. Teamsters. So here we have Aboriginal teamsters. Again, look at the material culture surrounding them. Here's this lovely dray. Here's the hooks, the shackles, the bridle on the horse, on the donkey, and the ubiquitous pipe. Again, we have this tobacco-based theme emerging. Now, this is a dray in our collection, but it's not in any way associated, historically known to be, with Indigenous teamsters. Again, same thing. Harness equipment, well-shined in this case, but part of the general... horse tack. It's classified under horse tack. Whaling. Whaling's a particularly interesting issue here because we're so close to Eden. These photographs come from Eden. This is... there's an image... I'm blurry here. An Aboriginal... young Aboriginal man here on the windlass for hauling the whales up. It's well acknowledged. Eden... Museum, Whaling Museum, fully acknowledges the Indigenous contribution in the whaling industry. This photograph, the title of this photograph is Aboriginal Whale Crew from Eden. Again, wouldn't it be great to have a whale boat in the Indigenous collections? This is that crew on action, harpoon at the ready. Again, the harpooner in the bows. Equipment. Well, these are the two. This is the owner of the whaling station and his son. But the equipment here is all the sort of equipment that the Aboriginal whale crews would have used. And used, you know, it's not just a one-off, this is a regular, this is their life, 30, 40 years of engagement. I think I've got my message across. Many histories are implicit but invisible in museum collections, and we need to go back and address this engagement with colonial society. There are important stories to be told, and it's important for the museums because it's often, we mediate, museums mediate between the public and perhaps the academy, so it's often the first place people will hear of these stories is through the museums. So what do our collections need? We need Toyotas, computers, pens, hats, tinnies, spanners, tools, medical equipment, you name it. If we don't collect the provenance of these items now, documenting their Indigenous associations, then 150 years from now, someone will complain that the Indigenous participation in the 21st century Australian economy, indeed Australian society as a whole, is inadequately represented in museum collections. I look forward to acquiring a helicopter. Richard Baker, one of three Aboriginal helicopter pilots in the Northern Territory, working with a company up there in mining, cattle mustering and everything else, many economic activities. And that's it. That's the slideshow. Thanks very much. No, but you know, that's the sort of thing we need. We need the because we concentrate on provenance material. Of course, you want things that come with associated stories. If they don't have the associated stories, the chance of them getting into the National Historic Collection is small. Although we do have another collection, just called the Museum Collection, you know, which is where a player might go in. But it's just a matter of recognising that Indigenous participation in the economy wasn't always just selling art and craft, or it was actually people working. And as I was mentioning. Out of coffee, but probably by the 1860s, 1870s, more Aboriginal people are employed, even at a pittance, or engaged in Western economic activities than are engaged in sort of a traditional lifestyle, simply because the population around the East Coast, beyond the frontier, basically. Once the frontier has passed, what are the survivors doing? And they're doing this sort of work. And I think the museums need to recognise that. Now, we know that the research is out there. So no criticism to researchers. Bit of a criticism to the museum and myself. Do I have any other questions?
I was just wondering if your issue is actually related to the objects, I understand this idea of provenance, but more to the story. I mean, are you going to duplicate things? Is the museum going to purchase a helicopter in the Indigenous collection and a helicopter in the whatever else collection? Because one is an Indigenous helicopter and the other one is a non-Indigenous helicopter.
Well, quite possibly. We have an aircraft, several aircraft in our collection already. If the story was appropriate, by provenance I don't just mean location, it also means that full history of use. You know, one day we may see an Indigenous-owned helicopter company doing this sort of work. Yes, if necessary. Multiples are not a problem. Well, what would be a hybrid or creole, you know, a plough with a dot painting on it or something? Yeah, once they're in the collections, they become part of the national collection. And we don't put them into separate stores so much, or we do have an ethno store. It's a matter of how they're documented. So the documentation can encompass both stories. This thing, plough was used on Corranderk Station or somewhere, or of cattle by Aboriginal people. The point is to write that Indigenous history in conjunction with the Western economic history. So to make sure that those stories are being told simultaneously. There's one last one, I think.
Thanks a lot for a very interesting presentation. Do you think that historical archaeological sites may play a role in providing the materials that, in Northern Territory, there's some fantastic sites in association with pastoral stations that are from the Indigenous occupation, and they're just full of all sorts of that material culture with spurs and plus stuff that's been modified into points and from glass. So that might change the significance of these places if they're underrepresented in your collections.
Look, absolutely. We've already had our eyes on buckets from the Canning Stock Route, well buckets, which were such an important, had such an important impact on Aboriginal lives there. The only thing is, of course, that museums can't go out willy-nilly and loot suit sites because we have to abide by state and heritage, state and territory heritage laws. So, you know, providing we get the state and territory to concede to us collecting, we'd happily take them.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.